name's Leszek, and I will be talking to Andrew Martinez Funds about product innovation, leadership, evolution, and agile transformation.
I'd like to start off with your professional journey. And could you take us briefly through your professional journey leading up to your current role as VP Product at Honey Sales?
Sure. I came out of college with an industrial design degree. It was called product design, but really it was about designing telephones and cars and things like that.
Physical
goods, exactly. But I had an internship the summer before my last year of university building websites with a small, it was actually a franchise of web development firms called US Web. It's no longer around, but it was with a small office of folks who were building what I would consider to be sort of early web apps. This was 1997, so pretty early in the internet's history. And I loved the confluence of interaction and graphic design and sort of the technical requirements or the underlying system model that needed to be fulfilled with those apps. And I actually took a job there after graduating. And so I spent the first 5 years of my career actually doing design and prototyping for web apps. My title was UI designer. I did a lot of UI design, but I also did a lot of prototyping. And I think this came from my school training, that the best way to show people what you're trying to build is to build it. And it might not be real. It might not actually have any back end to it, for example, if it's a web app, but just showing them how you might click around and perform a task and complete it end to end is super, super valuable. So I spent 5 years in really just kind of these web design and consulting firms. Ended up founding one with some friends for a couple of years and kind of building up, I would call my UX chops, basically. Mm-hmm. After that, I moved into a product management role at eBay. That was my first PM job. I spent only a couple of years there, but then moved to a small startup and then later to a much bigger clean tech firm, but all the while doing product management and eventually moving into a product leadership role as a group product manager, now a VP product. All of this happened in the US, and I moved to Germany in 2016 while I was working at Yelp. Yelp had acquired a company that was based in Hamburg, and an opportunity opened up to both move into a leadership role and move physically to Hamburg. And so we did that, me and my family. And since then, I've been in different leadership roles at a couple of different tech firms.
Okay. Cool. Thanks for that. Now, I'd like to talk a little bit about Honey Sales. Can you give us an overview of the product, of the business, and basically explain to us how, or explain to me, how it transforms the traditional sales process with its AI-driven approach?
Sure. Our mission here is to make every sales conversation relevant. Mm-hmm. And so in the sense that a salesperson wants to always have contextual relevance with the conversations that they're having with their prospects, with their customers, with somebody walking in off the street looking for to solve their problem, our goal is to equip sellers with those tools. And we use machine learning and AI to do that in a way that really just increases their efficiency. So we've talked in the past about potentially replacing sellers or something like that. I think it's really turned into helping sellers, giving them superpowers, essentially. So how do I take something that used to take me 10 hours a week and how do I condense it down to 30 minutes? And specifically, the problem we're trying to solve right now is, how do we help a seller find in their book of business the, we call them signals. What are the signals of activity in their network that make people, that might make someone open to having a sales conversation, and then giving them an opener, essentially, a message that says, hey, I just saw you got this new job. Would love to talk to you about how we can help you with your problem X. Or I just saw that you had a great quarter. We'd love to talk about how we can help you grow even more over the next year using our service, whatever it might be. But focused on business-to-business sellers, focused on AEs, account executives, and SDRs, sales development representatives, and just helping them do their jobs faster and with a lot more coverage, so to speak.
Okay, so there are two sides to it. One is recognizing the opportunity, And the second one is actually the super weapon, providing the context, providing everything to make the salesperson extremely successful at their job.
That's right. I wouldn't describe it as a weapon, but maybe a tool. That they can deploy for their needs. But yeah, essentially, you know, if I'm a seller with 1,000 prospects or a book of business of 1,000 accounts, how do I know when account X is ready to have a sales conversation? You know, that might be because they've just raised funding, or it might be because that particular contact just got a new position or a new title. Or it could be because they visited our pricing page, for example. And so how do we take all the signals that we get from around our product, the internet, et cetera, and work that into an opportunity for me to connect with that person? Rather than just the traditional approach is kind of spray and pray. Like every quarter I email all 1,000 people and I say, hey, I'm still here. I would love to sell you something. And, you know, the efficacy and frankly, the appeal of that approach is just not great.
Or manually set processes or flows that are arbitrary, set by some analyst rather than AI who can recognize much more, have much more context than, you know, setting it up like a hierarchical process or anything.
Yeah, and it seems like there are lots of examples around industry of companies doing just that and sort of understanding that AI may not necessarily solve every problem perfectly, but it can make humans more efficient, essentially. And I think that's kind of what we're finding as well. And the big question is, when will humans be comfortable letting go of the controls, or letting the reins go and letting the AI do things on its own, kind of autopilot mode, if you will? And when do they want to be more of a co-pilot and really managing the whole process? What we found in our research is that sellers are still very much in co-pilot mode. They don't want anything going out under their name that doesn't absolutely, you know, that they haven't reviewed and doesn't absolutely sound like them using their voice, et cetera. Because AI is not perfect, despite how great it can be. And so that's, to me, that's one of the interesting questions remaining to be answered.
Okay, very interesting. And how do you actually ensure personalization of communication? You said every sales conversation is relevant. Mm-hmm. I'm asking that because AI can sometimes lead to impersonal customer experience. Probably that's why the salespeople wanted to use it in a co-pilot setting. How do you basically maintain this balance between automation, personal touch, and all that stuff?
Yeah. So far we have not pursued automation. It's not a, we don't have a autopilot mode right now where somebody can just say go and this system is just shooting out emails. We do spend a lot of time on making sure that the prompts are right and providing AI with good examples of the messages that we expect to write. I mean, a sales outreach message has a fairly predictable pattern that we follow. And then we'll also observe what kinds of patterns are most effective and sort of feed that back into the system so that they improve over time. But we also take messages that the sellers have actually edited themselves, and we use those as examples as well. Like, hey, the last time this scenario came up, this person wrote something more like this. Please use this as your framework for developing the next message. Okay. And so far what we've seen is that it's pretty good at taking the context from what the seller is trying to do now, but the style or the template from what they did in the past, and merging those together into something pretty useful. Okay.
On the other hand, in the context of recognizing opportunities within your profile database, do you consider what kind of events are you looking after? Is it like, is there events related to, I don't know, purchases, conversations, but do you also consider some other relevant external events, say weather? It seems that it's, weather as an example, it seems relevant in many industries, say like fashion, shoes, whatever. Right. What kind of events do you actually put in the system or try to interpret to recognize the opportunities?
Yeah, so we're still about a year into this process, and so still, and I, that still feels pretty early, to be honest, and I've only been here for 5 months myself. We don't have weather incorporated as a factor yet. It'd be interesting to know if that has an impact on sales conversations. But right now it's kind of a confluence of the seller's goals themselves. So like, what are the audience or what's the ideal customer profile that they're going after? How well does the prospect match that goal? So if you have a book of business of 1,000 contacts, you know, there might be 100 that are actually the really hot ones mm-hmm. that are super important to you, interesting to you. And so we want to factor that into our scoring. We essentially score all of the mm-hmm. all of the signals that we get. And we want to also take into account sort of the closeness or the relevance of the signal to that person. So one of the most successful signals we use today is LinkedIn posts.
Mm-hmm.
You post something on LinkedIn about your podcast, and I'm a podcast software vendor or something like that. Like, that's a highly relevant signal for me to reach out and offer you something. We also use company news as a signal. But what we find is that if you work at a large company, a large industrial company like Siemens or Volkswagen or something, and you know it's just an article about the new car that Volkswagen developed, but you're in the you're in the manufacturing department, may actually not be a great mm-hmm. opportunity to connect with you. So it's one of the things that we're trying to figure out is how do we find the most relevant signals and also deliver them in a way that's useful.
I'd like to shift gears a bit and talk about product management. So my first question here is, in the light of the financial uncertainties, capital not being so abundant and all over the place, I'd like to ask about the measures we've taken to ensure product development remains agile and cost-effective. There's a lot of talk about that readjustment these days, and I'd like to ask about your perspective.
Part of the reason that I joined HoneySales is because I recognized that the founders already had a very capital efficient company running.
Uh-huh.
And part of that is obviously the amount that they wanted to allocate to product and engineering. And the team that we have is very slim. It's basically a product manager and four engineers. And what we do is try to make the most progress as we can with the team that we have, while also bringing in specialists when we need them. So if we need a security specialist, we bring them in. If we need a designer to help us with something, we'll bring them in as needed. And so far that's worked out fairly well in the sense that we can make measurable and specific progress while not having to hold on to people for a terribly long time. But that core team also kind of maintains the knowledge mm-hmm. we need in the long run. Obviously, I'd love to have more engineers. I'd love to have a full-time designer, you know, all of those things. But I think the big challenge for us as a company right now, or for any company at our stage, is finding product market fit. And so until we really have that locked down and we know both what the product needs to be, how we bring it to market, all of those things that get you to start scaling, it doesn't necessarily make a lot of sense to invest a ton until we find it.
You worked in different settings, and you've probably seen the other way to do it, or the other end of the scale or the spectrum.
Sure.
Could you say what were your experiences in the past? And there are many stories out there about overgrowing or over engineering, overgrowing the employee base. I wonder if you've seen such approach in the market.
I guess I'm lucky to say I haven't been in a situation where a company overgrew and then had to dramatically shrink back down. I guess thankfully, and I would say that the situation of the last few years is not indistinct from what happened in the late 90s with the dot-com uh-huh. bubble. Companies overhired and then had to cut back when cash became scarce. And the same thing is happening here. And frankly, I think it was a bit overdue. I mean, we probably shouldn't have had to wait 20 years for everyone to remember what that was like. So to me, it's not necessarily like a unique situation, but it is, I think it's just a cautionary tale to anyone at any stage of building a company that you really have to be precious with your resources. And not only that, but the costs of constantly hiring and also even just losing people through attrition are very high. And so when you're when you're recruiting, like, you've got to be sure that you're finding the right people.
Exactly. So
and I would also say that, you know, the firms that were founded after the .com bubble, Facebook being the main one that comes to mind right now, like, the reason that company was so successful for so many years is because they had that memory, you know, that so many of the managers and executives from that firm had participated in the previous downturn. And so they understood what it meant to be.
A large portion of the most successful companies were born out of a crisis.
And that'll happen in this case too. You know, it's just, we just don't know who they are yet.
I'm very much into trying to get some practices or approach or mindset in terms of being innovative, taking risks, and from US and transplanting it to European way of building new things and innovating. And I'd like to explore that for a while, since you've been on both sides of the pond. and in that theme, I'd like to ask you about the pitfalls of scaling product teams and processes, and how to make it successful, how to make the processes your friend, not your enemy. At the same time, keep you, make you innovative, but also agile.
You know, this is one person's perspective, and I don't mean to, you know, diminish anyone on either side of the pond about how they do things. So my experiences are only my own. But my observation, having worked in Germany now for a few years, and to be clear, it's not just a German thing. It's, you know, I've worked with people from across Europe, from across the world as well. I mean, the world of product and engineering is international everywhere you are, whether you're in the US or Europe or anywhere else. But generally, if I had to boil it down, the mindset in the US, I think, is much more, is much less risk averse. So much more interested in taking chances, seeing what happens, shooting first and asking questions later. Whereas the European approach, I would say, is a lot more conservative. And it's like, listen, let's plan this out. Let's make sure we know what we're doing. Let's test it. And then maybe we'll put it out there. And this translates not just to product development, but just to the, you know, frankly, to labor laws, to the way that business operates generally.
Maybe also gene pool. That's, you know, there were lots of entrepreneurs from Ireland for basically with nothing but their own will to go, you know, through the sea, sell it up there, and like that. These are like a natural selection of entrepreneurs. That's at least, I don't think this explains it all, but I mean, I think that's a part of it as well. But that's my own theory.
Could be. But I think what this translates into, you know, across thousands of examples, and, you know, assuming that this is true, what it sort of translates to is that there's a little less risk taking, and so that multiplied over thousands of weeks or months and thousands of companies and so forth means that there's just been a little bit more of a slower mentality to getting things done. So that's what I've observed on the innovation side. And so I think what I try to do when I come to my teams is, you know, it's not so much shoot first and ask questions later, but it's like, how can we learn something as quickly as possible in this situation, mm-hmm. right? It, obviously, we don't know the answers to everything. And anytime you try to pin someone down, the answer is always, I don't know yet. And I need some time to figure it out. I say that myself. And so that's natural. But the question is, what's the smallest piece of progress that we can make so we can learn something new and then go figure out the next small piece of progress so we can build upon it? And so just to give you a very specific example, when I joined Honey Sales, we had our work split up. We used Notion for task tracking, and we had things split up into tasks, stories, and epics, and kind of the classic Agile or the Scrum model. And I said, listen, epics, like, let's get rid of them. Like, let's just operate at the story level. Like, what are the things that we want to learn about, what to do so we can learn about them? And let's just do them as stories. And a story shouldn't be more than a couple of weeks of work. And let's just try to make some progress and actually get things going. You know, and basically finish things rather than constantly starting new ones.
And the stories are aligned towards experimenting and learning. That's the...
Yeah, in some cases, they're... In some cases, they represent just progress that we need to make on a certain component or whatever. But ultimately, the idea is every story is a hypothesis that we want to prove.
Nice.
And my point being that rather than saying, look, this is a big six-month effort where we're going to not have something until the very end, like what can we have next week? And how can that help us move forward with our goals? And if you don't release something next week that you can evaluate, then you won't know where to go for the following week, right? Like it'll give you hints that help point you in the same direction, in the right direction, hopefully. Anyway, so that's on the first question about innovation. And the second one on process, the observation that I had when I moved to Hamburg initially was how obsessed everybody was with Agile and how job listings said, you know, you work in an Agile way and you're familiar with the Agile methodology and so forth. And as much as I'm, it's not that I disagree with the Agile manifesto or anything like that, but my sense was that people put a lot more energy than they needed to into process and to like, how are we going to do this rather than just doing it? Mm. And so again, it's one thing that I try to push for in the team is like, let's not get hung up in ceremony or in whatever, like let's do it because there is value there, but let's not be too orthodox. And let's use what's going to make sense for us at our size, at our company maturity, at the level of product market fit that we have, and so forth.
Nice. I think there's a coming back to the financial uncertainties and capital not being so abundant. I think it also there's an aspect of it that. Results in shift in Agile where it's less about ceremonies. Generally, I'm not referring to honey sales, but I'm speaking generally that there's less like the ceremonies become less important. There's also like a shift from, you know, Scrum Masters, Agile coaches that are not really bringing that much value. I think it's more about getting things done these days. So actually, I think it's really cool. Considering what we discussed so far, and as actually some kind of rebirth of getting things done with having constraints on the capital side and timeline.
Yeah, I'm glad to hear that. I haven't observed that myself, but I would be very happy to hear it.
Yeah, I think it like that's one side of it, but also I think from the engineering perspective, there's also a lot of stuff happening. For example, there's a trend to go after simpler architecture. For example, let's not do like complex microservices that can handle thousands or hundreds requests more than we actually need, and it's built for the future. Let's build something simple and a monolith that will do the job itself and will do for the time being. So, there are many, aspects of it, but I think it's actually I really enjoy these times.
Yeah, it's I hope that's a trend.
About my final question to you is related to leadership, and specifically about your style and how it evolved over the years. You've been in the industry for over 20 years, and I'm just wondering how your style has evolved. What are the critical lessons you've learned along the way?
It's not, I don't think it's in my resume, although it might be that right after I started at this company, US Web, we were growing very fast. This was the boom time of the late 90s. And I was promoted into a management role for the UI design team. And I had this very specific style of doing design work, which was actually in code. So I was writing HTML and a little bit of script to make things, to build these prototypes and to show people how to actually do things. And we were hiring people into the team who didn't have experience doing that. And I had this, I would say, very stubborn approach of like, hey, if you're going to join this team, you're going to learn how to do this too, because this is to some extent what we expect for our customers. And I thought it was the right way to do things.
Made an assumption that it's...
Yeah, essentially. So you see where this is going. Like, I don't think I was a very good... I wasn't a very good manager at all. I may have been going in the right direction of leadership, but it was not necessarily a productive method of leadership of like showing people where to go, but I was a lot more focused on showing them how to do it or how to make that happen. And thankfully that period only lasted a little while. And then I went back to being an individual contributor. And it wasn't until I had a lot more sort of, I would call formal management experience, or I had the experience of being managed by more formal leaders, by more trained leaders, essentially, that I understood that, management is a completely different job than being an individual contributor, right? If you're a product manager or an engineer who wants to move into a management role, you sort of need to understand that, like, your life is going to change from one day to the next. And your skill set hopefully can still serve you in terms of how you coach your team or you work with them, but the job itself is
a new game.
Change a lot. It's a whole new ballgame. And I think what I experienced was that being a manager, and I think I eventually became a fairly good manager, but being a manager is different than being a leader. And you asked about leadership specifically, and I think the thing I've been trying to steer myself back into more over time is actually being a leader. And from what I understand about what that means is that to some extent it's the management stuff, it's the day, week to week one-on-ones and the coaching and all those things. But it's also frankly pointing a path for the team and helping them understand, again, not necessarily how to do it, but where we're going and like what is the goal that we're trying to achieve? How will we measure ourselves when we get there? That's been a bigger part of my recent leadership journey. And in this role, because I am the basically executive in charge of the product and engineering team, I find myself having to use that or develop that skill, or I feel myself needing that skill a lot more in this role, because it really is about helping the team understand where we're going and kind of letting them figure out the rest as much as possible.
Nice.
So that's been, I guess to summarize, it's been like, I think I started as a just maybe too strong of a leader. I over time realized what it meant to be a manager, and then I've realized actually management is not leadership, and that's also a skill worth developing. So who knows, maybe I'll find some third dimension of this that I hadn't before, but for me it's been a sort of an interesting journey.
But also I think it also comes down to there's one requirement here, which is you also already mentioned that you have to have a great team as well. Mm-hmm. to grow as a leader, and not being the manager, but also a leader at the same time.
Right. Andrew, thank you very much. It was really a pleasure.
Yeah, you're welcome. I'm glad.
Better tech leadership powered by BrainHub. Follow Les Schick on LinkedIn and subscribe to the Better Tech Leadership newsletter.